With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Craig Simon's new book is Nimitz at War, Command Leadership from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. He is an emeritus professor of history from the U.S. Naval Academy. And we're speaking of Chester Nimitz at war in the Pacific. It is now the point where the Central Pacific campaign, starting in the Gilbert Islands, driving towards the Japanese islands, is underway with the landing at Tarawa, a small island, a series of atolls. And this is where the Marines have to practice their amphibious landing that will get better and stronger throughout the war. In fact, amphibious landings in general are now being invented by the Marines and the Army, and they require specialized ships that don't exist at this point. You all think of the landing craft from D-Day, the drop of the front and the men piling out. Well, that didn't exist as they land at Tarawa. This is November of 1943. The professor's book concentrates on relationships, however. So we begin with Chester Nimitz's relationship with the U.S. Marine Corps. He worked very well through Halsey with Vandegrift at Guadalcanal. But now we introduce a man named Holland Smith. What is that relationship, Professor? Thank you.
Well, Holland Smith was the man who was in charge of Marine Corps training. And in the previous decade, the Marines had made amphibious operations their particular area of expertise. This derived in part from the fact that in World War I, the Marines had fought in France as if they were a regular army division. And they realized that in order to maintain their unique character and personality, they needed to develop a particular expertise. And aware that Japan was a likely foe, they developed throughout the late 20s and the 30s this expertise in amphibious operations. We now associate the Marines with amphibious operations from the start, but that really is a relatively new thing here. And the training for this was supervised by Holland Smith. Holland Smith was not a patient man. His nickname, his name is Holland M. Smith, H.M. Smith. And of course, he got to be known as Howling Mad Smith because of his tendency to fly off the handle when things did not go well. But he considered the Marines his own, and he was particularly determined to make sure that he was not only in charge, but that he took care of his men as they went ashore in this first major amphibious operation of the Central Pacific Drive at Tarawa. And the difficulty there, the geographical difficulty, is like many islands that are part of an atoll in the Pacific. There was a large coral shelf that extended from the beach a quarter mile or more out into the ocean. And the landing craft the Marines were to use required at least 3.5, probably 4 feet of water to make sure they could get ashore. And there was a neap tide at Tarawa in November of 1943, and many of those landing craft got stuck on the coral shelf. The Marines had to climb out over the side and wade ashore through withering machine gun fire. And of course, Howling Mad Smith was irate about this.
These events are taking place while Nimitz is also dealing with competing personalities and opinions at headquarters. And we need to introduce some of those conflicts because this isn't about battles. Those are profound and tragic. This is about flag officers dealing with their plans and their disappointments in their experiences. There is an admiral named John Towers who becomes the deputy commander-in-chief of the Pacific, Deputy SINCPAC. He is an aviator first and a naval officer after that. And that conflict with Nimitz is a reprise of other conflicts that we see, brown shoes versus black shoes. Nimitz Chester Nimitz did not seem to have a great deal of patience with John Towers, although he kept including him into conversations to calm him down. Is Towers regarded today as someone who had a better idea, who was more disposed towards the aircraft? Because more and more equipment is now showing up. It's no longer the shortages of 1942.
Towers has his defenders in the historical community, but he has more who I think recognize that Towers was simply a difficult personality. In fact, the only reason he's in the Pacific, or at least the major reason he's in the Pacific, is because King found him intolerable as head of the Bureau of Aeronautics in Washington. He made King's life more difficult. And in order to get him out of Washington, he foisted him on Chester Nimitz. Nimitz also didn't particularly want to work with John Towers, who was difficult, but he accepted, again, realizing that he needed to accommodate when necessary. He accepted that this was necessary. What made Towers difficult was largely the fact that Towers believed to his very core that only aviators should ever be allowed to have any command authority over carriers or airplanes or air groups. Therefore, people like Spruance, people like Nimitz should never be able to tell aircraft carriers what they should do. It should only ever be an aviator. And so he was a particular champion, for example, of Mark Mitcher. King was more interested in getting the right man to do the job, regardless of his service affiliation. That's why he put Fletcher in charge of a carrier group and Spruance in charge of a carrier group. Now, Halsey did have wings, and so he was okay by Towers' standards, but Towers would not tolerate Fletcher or Spruance, or for that matter, Nimitz. And Nimitz had to put up with this.
You recall that Mitcher was challenged after Midway. And I use the word escrow. The professor uses the word escrow. Mitcher is back. Mark Mitcher is now commanding the air part of the Fifth Fleet, and which will eventually become the Fifth and the Third Fleet. And Mitcher is restored, rewarding Nimitz's opinions of giving people second chances.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think that if Spruance had been the decision maker here, Mitcher never would have come back. Spruance never quite forgave him for his missteps at Midway. But Nimitz believed that not only he deserved a second chance, he saw something in Mitcher and went to Spruance and said, I'm going to make him a carrier group commander. If he does well in that, he might take over the carriers as a group. And Spruance, very Nimitz-like, accepted that this was something he simply had to put up with. And down the road, of course, Mitcher becomes the great, magnificent Mitcher, as he's known to his biographer. So it works out.
Tarawa is a bloodbath, and Nimitz visits it after it's been secured. And the quote in the professor's book, "The first time I've smelled death." It was an appalling failure of good intelligence and good planning for naval bombardment. There were corrections made, but we need to focus on the theme of calculated risk, because it comes up again now when we go to the Marshall Islands. Gilbert's first. We're going right up the center. Marshalls are next. The Allied opinion is we should start with a small part of the Marshalls, and Nimitz says Kwajalein. What's his thinking, Professor?
Well, he knows that Kwajalein is the heart of this. It's where the main Japanese base is. And if you take the heart, if you choke that off, all the other auxiliary islands will fall by the wayside. But the fear is not just in among the Joint Chiefs, but among his own subordinate commanders. His amphibious commander, his air commander, his ground, all say, no, Kwajalein's too tough. We should go to one of the outer islands first. Look how hard Tarawa was. But Nimitz, who had visited Tarawa, as you point out, believed that he learned from that experience all the things that needed to be done to make an amphibious operation more efficient. He ordered that they be applied. He got different kind of landing craft. He developed a new protocol for targeting naval gunfire on the beach and said, nope, we're going to go straight to Kwajalein. I think we can do this. And, of course, it was done quickly, with minimal loss, and he was therefore justified in that decision. But here's another case, as you point out, of applying calculated risk. It was a bit of a risk, but Nimitz assumed the benefit was greater than the risk.
Two big sea battles, telling the story of Spruance and Halsey when we come back. The book is Nimitz at War, Command Leadership from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Craig Simons is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.